This is Identity at the Center.
If it has anything to do with IAM, this is the go-to podcast. Now your hosts, Jim McDonald and Jeff Stedman.
Welcome to the Identity at the Center podcast. I'm Jeff and that's Jim. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Jeff. How are you?
Not so bad. Yourself?
I'm doing great. I mean, there's been some interesting news in the identity space recently with Thoma Bravo closing their deal to acquire ForgeRock. It seems to me, based on my LinkedIn, that people from Ping and from ForgeRock seem pretty excited about, you know, the future. I mean, I've only seen positive come out. I don't know that. I mean, everybody's speculating. What does this actually mean? What is this going to look like in the future? I'd like to extend an invitation to anyone from Thoma Bravo or Ping or ForgeRock who wants to come in and talk on the record on the podcast to please reach out to me or Jeff. And we'd love to have you on because people, we all want to know what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, I think people have been thinking about this for a while, ever since, you know, the intent was announced several months back now at this point. We asked the question on stage at Gartner to our, you know, our friends Henrique and Becky. they didn't know, right? Just like anyone else. I think we're starting to see it now, right? So the deal is closed. And I think almost immediately they announced, the merging of the two companies, ForgeRock and Ping. And Andre Duran has been announced as the leader for that. So it's interesting times. It's never a dull moment in the identity space. I think we kind of saw, what's the plan here? Be curious to see how things continue to evolve in the space. But definitely happy to talk with anybody from Ping or ForgeRock wants to come on and talk about it. Maybe we can get Eve. Eve's always been good with us.
Eve's been great.
Yeah.
I just don't know how much, how much freedom she'll have to talk about that kind of stuff. But
I'm going
to
go on a limb and say none. I mean, it's companies, it's corporate, there's money involved, right? Stocks, maybe. I'm sure we'll get, company lines and stuff like that. But it's interesting to see how things will, turn out. What's the plan here between ForgeRock and Ping? In certain areas, they're definitely competitors. What's the plan to fold those together and figure out, how it makes each other better or stronger or faster or something like that?
I mean, the customer list of those two companies now combined is just unreal. Mm-hmm. But by the way, you did bring up Andre Duran. If I could mention, he's Identity at the Center alumni. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that was the highlight of his career, of course, up to this moment anyway.
As it should be for anybody.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's cool news. I'm sure this is going to be the biggest thing that folks are talking about at the upcoming conferences. We've got quite a few of them planned.
I mean, it's kind of hard. It's the elephant in the room, the grill in the corner, whatever the right analogy is. But I'm sure people are talking about it, especially when we start talking about authentication. So we've got a few things coming up like that. But we've got conferences coming up. So I'm going to be at Identity Week America. That's October 3rd and 4th. That's in Washington, D.C. I'm hosting a panel discussion on passkeys. Actually starting to get the panel together later this week. So we're actually starting to figure out what it is we're going to talk about and try to put together, a good discussion around passkey and authentications, things like that. So we've got a discount code that the fine folks over there have provided to us. This works for both Identity Week America and also work for Identity Week Asia later this year. So if you use the code IDAC30, you get 30% off of your conference pass. And we're actually dividing and conquering that week because I'm going to be on the East Coast at DC at Identity Week America, and you're going to be on the West Coast over at Octane.
Yeah, I'll be at Octane. But one thing we will have in common is we'll both have the new updated Identity at the Center stickers.
And what's you got to be clear what the update means.
Yeah, the update the doesn't logo mean a new look. No, but the old stickers had a fatal flaw, which was they were very hard to get the backing off of. And so now the new and improved stickers are super easy to get the backing off of. I mean, look, it's like these little tweaks. It's like the iPhone, from iPhone 14 to iPhone 15. I don't know what all the features are going to be sitting here today, but they're probably going to seem like small features that just make it so much nicer to have. So anyway, well, you'll have stickers. I'll have stickers. I'll be at Octane 2023 in San Francisco, October 3rd through the 5th. And we have a discount code for that conference as well, which is OKTNIDAC30. It gets you 30% off your registration. So the registration link is okta.com/octane. And we're also going to be co-hosting or co-organizing an event with our friends from Accents. We're going to be doing the quote-unquote party bus, which shouldn't scare people, right? It's not like we're going to be driving all over the city and, you know, just going crazy. We're going to be doing some cool, sane, fun things and networking and seeing some of the highlights of San Francisco. I mean, it's tech town, right? So a lot of the corporate headquarters are there. I think we're going to do some of that. I'm not the consigliere of the party bus, but I'm expecting it to be a lot of good, sane fun. So anybody who's interested in that, check out my LinkedIn. I've reposted the link to get registered. And as we get closer, I'll drop that more and we'll put it in the show notes as well.
Yeah, right on. I saw pictures from the party bus in Vegas. I didn't make it, but you were on there. And it was interesting going around and see the sites. It was a cool idea. I think it was kind of a neat thing that they did. So
yeah, I mean, we did things like we went to the Welcome to Las Vegas sign. We all got to go out and take pictures. And yeah, it just it added another element to the trip. It was like, for all the times I've been to Vegas, which was like over 20 times, I'd never gotten to that sign before. When you get there, you're just like, oh my gosh, this is like on just some rando street.
Yeah, I've never been to it either. So maybe someday. So we got that Octane. We've also got the Authenticate conference that we're going to be at the week after that, or a couple weeks after that. That is October 16th to the 18th, Carlsbad, California, just north of San Diego. We have a code for them as well. IDAC15 podcast. You get 15% off. Which is very cool. We're actually going to be on the main stage, part of the kind of opening festivities and keynotes. And we're going to do a live show in front of a live studio audience and also broadcast it to the internet at large for guests and conference people and stuff like that. I still have no idea what we're going to talk about. We got to figure that out. That's coming up. But that'll be exciting.
Can't wait for that. I mean, we are the official podcast for the Authenticate conference, and that discount code of 15%, that's the best discount code available anywhere. So if you use that code, in addition to getting the 15% off, you get registered in a raffle of some sort that the conference organizers are going to select one of the people and give them a welcome gift of some sort. I don't know what the gift is going to be. I don't know all the details, but use the darn code because it's the best one out there anyway.
Yeah. And it supports us too, right? Shows that people actually listen to this stuff and it's worth our time and their time, right, to help support that. So yeah, looking forward to that. That's going to be a lot of fun. Anything else you want to bring up before we get to our main topic? Because we're going to talk a little about authorizations.
I do want to bring up one thing, just a thought that I have. And usually I bring this up at the end, which is if folks can get out there, if they like the podcast, subscribe to it. Leave us a 5-star review would be appreciated. Let people know, because that's how people get to know about it. That's how, when you go into the podcast search feature of your podcast app, we show up first when someone types in identity. And it's really, you know, there's nothing that Jeff and I can do to improve that algorithm. It's really
not yet,
you know.
I got my flipper. Maybe I can use the flipper zero somehow to do that.
Yeah, so far all you're able to do is copy your hotel keys, but that's still a nice little feature.
Yeah, I've copied hotel keys and also the badge system for my in-laws housing complex. So yeah. Definitely some things that could
those
be
are
done
two
there.
Good things, but if I saw you at Starbucks, I would not connect to the Wi-Fi.
I did get the Wi-Fi dev board, so I have been playing around with that. There's a couple of, you know, interesting things you can do. Set up like an evil portal. You can do a Rickroll attack, which basically creates a whole bunch of fake access points that are Rickroll lyrics. So, you know, I'm definitely not a hacker, you know, in quotation marks, but there's some neat things you can kind of do that are fun and explain to people just, you know, why they should be using things like MFA and things like that.
I think you are a hacker. I mean, you might be very green in the hacker stack, but you're doing hacker things.
Okay, well, I don't want this to be evidence, so let's just keep going. Let's talk about authorization. And I'm kind of calling this authorization 2.0. I don't know if that will stick or not, but to help us with this conversation, we've got Rich Danleicher. He's the chief strategist with Veza. Welcome to the show, Rich.
Thanks, Jeff. Hey, it's great to be here. How you doing, Jim?
Great to have you here. First of all, I love the radio pipes. You've got a great voice for podcasts. I will try my best to keep up. I might actually, I'm trying to like bring people's voices up and make the sounds, you know, sparkling, you know, right in the editing. I might have to like do the opposite for you so that there isn't such a disparity between you, me, and Jim. But
well, usually people only tell me that I have a face for radio, but now I also have the voice.
Well, that's what we always say. We got faces for radio and voices for a silent movie, something like that. Well, thanks for joining us and spending some time with us here today. We like to really learn about the identity journey that people have been on. And it's kind of tradition around here when we have someone on for the first time to understand what their identity origin story is. So maybe you can just spend just a minute or two kind of talking about how did you get into the space of identity and access management or digital identity or whatever the heck we're calling this field today.
Yeah, it actually started when I was at Okta, and I actually back in 2014, I went and joined them, and I led the product management team for about 4.5 years through the IPO period. And so, you know, I think identity had definitely struck a chord with me, and that was one of the things I did a stint in data loss prevention, and really seeing how, you know, sort of network-based security tools were just not the thing you really wanted to see. You needed to get down to the person, and that was really hard. You had to go through proxies. You had to do all sorts of fancy dancing to get there. And so that, you know, identity was definitely something that was like top of my list, and then Okta really cemented that for me. And I think it's been a fantastic journey. And, my early on in my career, I definitely said, wow, this is a lot more complex than I thought it was when I started.
It always is. I think the definition too of kind of being an identity has changed. A lot of people find themselves, they just were in it all of a sudden. They didn't like pick it. It was just, oh, I guess I'm in identity now. And now you're a chief strategist for an identity company. So I love titles because some of them are very cool. Some of them like, okay, what the heck does that even mean? What does a chief strategist for an identity company like Veza do?
That's a great question, because I definitely find it strategy means lots of different things at lots of different places. It could mean a whole lot, and it can mean a whole lot of nothing. But for us at Veza, I tend to split my time between a number of different pillars. First is really around sort of high-level product marketing and messaging. So I think a lot about how we position the solution that we provide, how we talk about our customers, how we talk about the space that we're in. So that bleeds into a lot of analyst relations and speaking to the folks like Gartner and speaking to Enrique, as well as sort of looking at the market as a whole and, you know, sort of kind of getting into competitive analysis as well. So that bleeds into the second pillar, which is helping out our sales team. So, you know, really being sort of more out on the front lines, helping to, you know, to guide the folks that are actually talking directly to prospects about sort of how to talk about things, how to position things, what people care about, and what identity folks really want to, you know, are what's top of their list. And then the third is on product strategy. So actually building new product, working on some of the advanced things that we want to get done that are critical for sort of that long-term positioning in the market and sort of really helping take us where we want to go in a long term.
So speaking of product, you've got this company called Veza, V-E-Z-A. And I'm sure you get confused with Visa a lot, people saying it. So let's get the word out there, right? It's pronounced Veza. For those people who are not familiar with what Veza does, what's the elevator pitch? 30, let's say 60 second elevator ride up. What do you guys do?
Yeah, I think the way I like to talk about it is really that we help companies operationalize least privilege. So we do that by really putting together a graph around authorization that shows you not just what you have across all your different systems, but where it's wrong, where you need to fix it. Right. So we have a core technology, which is our authorization metadata graph, where we really put together all the different pieces of information about authorization, from users to groups to roles, all the way down to specific resources that might be in a particular system and the permissions, down to, you know, can you read, can you write, can you edit, can you delete, and putting that together. And I think that combination makes a really powerful solution to both see what you've got, as I said, fix it, and also get to compliance, right? And that's a frequent driver for a lot of customers. And we have we came out of stealth last year. We've got a number of big customers like Wynn Resorts, AMD, Intuit, Blackstone, Amex Global Business Travel, and Zoom. So, you know, like it's something that's really, I think, resonated in the market because it's so hard just to see what you've got. And that's often where customers start with us.
Yeah, I think a lot of people think identity, they think authentication. It's the next step after that. It's really where you're going is the authorization side. So where does the name Veza come from?
Yeah, well, actually, it's an interesting story. When I first joined the company, we had a different name. We were called Cookie.ai. And this is even before ChatGPT. So it was prescient in one way about having the AI... the .ai there, but you know, obviously, cookie.ai has a lot of baggage. So that was one where I was like, yeah, I don't know if that's going to really fly long term. And so I actually helped drive the new naming, and Veza comes from the Zulu word meaning to reveal. So I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. If I had to pick a language that I based the name on, Zulu's probably, yep, that's about the peak of it. And it has a good meaning. We could get the .com domain for not an outrageous amount of money. And the ticker symbol was available. You know, you always got to be thinking ahead.
Hey, Rich, authorizations really seem to have blown up in the past year or so. And if someone asked me, you know, what's hot in identity right now, run down a list of, you know, converged identity, which I don't think is that exciting, decentralized, KIM, ITDR, passwordless, and authorization. And it's like that whole list I went through until I got to authorization, those are all new things, right? They're all things that have kind of happened in the past several years. But authorization has been around for pretty much the beginning of identity. And so I'm wondering, what do you attribute this blowing up of authorization, as I put it? What do you attribute that to?
I really think it's a consequence of most organizations really pushing forward with authentication. And and props to Okta, props to Microsoft, really for driving forward the world of SSO, you know, with SAML and OIDC and getting MFA implemented and driving forward on passwordless. So most companies that I talk to have really, you know, they've kind of gone through that and they've said, yep, we've done the lion's share of what we need to do around authentication. And wow, things aren't fixed yet. We still have all these issues. We're still getting we have security attacks. We still don't really have a handle on identity. It's not a solved problem yet. And so it's just as you said, it's a very natural thing. After you've gone and tackled authentication, authorization is the next step. Right. And so I think that natural sort of like, you know, what do we do next? We know there's something here. We know how core identity is to all these different things, to the, you know, to the IT stack, to the security stack. And yet, you know, it's not, we know we're not done.
Now, Rich, when we talk about frameworks for authentication, some of the ones that our listeners may be familiar with are RBAC, ABAC, PBAC. Some of those people might not be familiar with. Could you help us define each one of those and tell us which one's the best one?
What a loaded question. That's awesome. So yeah, RBAC is a role-based access control. So this is probably what I see as the most commonly used one. And you'll be used to this in an enterprise scenario where you'll have some sort of description. You know, I might be like a West marketing, or, you know, I'm a super admin. And that sort of gives you, based on a role, There's some commonality across an organization that collects up a bunch of different permissions that's organized in sort of your function at the organization into a role. That's the ideal state. Then you have things like ABAC, which attribute-based access control. And that's where you're not doing it necessarily in a role, but, you know, typically more dynamically. Like, you know, you can think of, I think the best analogy is you're used to this around sort of, you know, attribute-based authentication, right? It might be geolocation-based, right? Where you're pulling in some attributes, oftentimes dynamically, and making a decision about, all right, is this person actually allowed to get to certain resources and take certain actions on certain resources based on the value of those attributes? So there's it's typically done more at runtime and more dynamically. and then policy-based access control, where you're it's a pretty similar kind of thing and a lot of similarities to ABAC, but it tends to be a bit more around design so that you can actually make broad policy-based changes across the organization without having to go through and rejigger all your roles, right? So it's sort of more a goal and a target design from what I've seen. RBAC is the most commonly used one, and you know, and I know we talked about this. It's like for me being in the authorization space, I'm amazingly not opinionated about which one is best. So that's a tough question for me, but I know that my favorite one was I was listening to one of the CISOs I was talking to. He says, RBAC, yeah, really bad access control. And I think I have a strong resonance with that because even though that's the most commonly used one, that's the one that I see most often. It just has so many gaps and so many holes.
Can you have least privilege without RBAC?
You know, least privilege is obviously it's a big slope. And I think really the trick is like, you know, and this is also, you know, I don't want to pitch, but you know, it's like everybody agrees least privilege is something you need to get to, but getting it in practice and you know, how do you actually get an operational program? You know, we've all gone through those compliance surveys and said, hey, do you follow least privilege? I'm like, yes, we do. But what does that mean? Like, you know, and how do you know, and where is it off, and how can you get better? Those are the, you know, when the rubber meets the road, I think those are the most important questions. So I see it as less of a, you know, are you using RBAC or ABAC or PBAC? It's more around, do you have the tools and the processes and the people to actually get to least privilege? Least privilege is the goal, no matter which of these frameworks you're trying to do.
Jeff, Rich refuses to answer my question. What's the best back? What is the best back?
Well, it's baby back. I mean, without question.
Baby
got back. Got back. Finally answered.
And that is the winner, folks. Okay. So, Rich, it seems like that in the past, at least in my experience, authorization was an area focused on for CIM, customer IM, and less so for enterprise. But it seems like this blowing up that I refer to is really a reversal of that trend, and it's becoming more of a shift toward enterprises doing more advanced authorization projects or taking that authorization focus. Is that right? Do you agree with that?
Yep, I do. And I think traditionally authorization has been sort of front and center of a CIAM project, just because when you're building a custom application, which is typically what those things, what's involved there, you can't not build authorization in, right? You've got to have something. And so you have to build some sort of structure, some sort of componentry. I think, to be fair, I'd say that, you know, the CIAM types of projects haven't gone away. And actually, we're seeing a really strong push here, not so much in terms of sort of the bulk users that are going into an application. For instance, if you're a customer, a consumer facing company, and you have a CIAM application, you've generally done a pretty good job of separating and isolating customer one from customer two. Like I can't, you know, if I'm going into Expedia, I can't get to Jeff's travel profile and access Jeff's credit cards. And then for the most part, that's a well understood problem. The trick, and I think the sort of the frontier for that on the CIAM side is really things like help desk people, right? If you have, you know, you have admins or DevOps people who are logging in and sort of getting access to customer data, getting privileged permissions into some of these things, potentially cutting across multiple customers, doing some sort of operational management and of that. I find a lot of customers weren't thinking about that. That's not sort of the primary use case of authorization in that custom app. And so they often have very little visibility, especially when you get to the security team. You've got the developers, you're kind of, you know, there's one guy who knows exactly how it all works. But then when you go to the security team, they don't have visibility, they don't have logins, they don't know how it works. And that's a real, real gap there on the CIAM side. But to your point, I think it's now also hitting on the sort of the enterprise application side. And I think there's a lot of crossover because some of the data storage systems, like going to the cloud platforms of AWS and Azure and Google Cloud, those are now sort of crossing over where they're being used for enterprise data. They're also being used for customer data. And so, you know, you really see a lot of commonality in leveraging similar platforms across the internal enterprise, traditional internal enterprise applications and consumer applications and customer applications.
So when I talk about authorization with people, my mind shifts back to the framework around the Zachamel standard and, you know, policy decision point, policy enforcement point. And again, like my reference point is a lot on customer IAM. And I've always thought like, okay, externalizing and centralizing the policy decision point is pretty drastic. You know, if you've got a couple of, you know, business portals for transacting, whether it's placing orders or warranties, it depends on what business you happen to be in. But a lot of times those applications were built individually, right? They're not just one big portal that does it all. And to centralize all that, I always thought to myself, like, okay, that probably makes sense for like the FBI or something like that, where they want to have a centralized log of those policy decisions. So to me, the policy decision point was always like the big, most important component of that framework, a way of thinking about Zachamel. And I'm wondering, like, does that framework still hold value? Do you still use that framework and that type of those terms, policy decision point, policy enforcement point, things like that? And, you know, is the policy decision point still the most important concept of that standard, or is it something else now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think those, especially those concepts, are very valid today, as valid as they were when the standards were being developed there. And I think that sort of methodology and that conceptual division makes a ton of sense. And I find that, you know, it's still a small fraction of folks. We tend to not talk about those things as explicitly in today, like in our marketing and documentation materials. But I definitely run across plenty of customers who still talk about it and say, hey, you know, tell me how this fits into that world. And so I think there are definitely folks out there who still think about it this way. And I think if you explain it to them, it makes a ton of sense. Here's one where I actually am opinionated, and this is one where I'll put in my vote for my favorite. My favorite component is the policy administration point, and that's one where I think the issue with sort of centralizing, as you pointed out, with the decision point, it's really, you know, there's a performance issue. You're generally, you know, you're looking at that with the enforcement point potentially, and putting those things together, I think, tends to make a lot of sense. But trying to reroute the network and trying to, channel everything to a single choke point, that's not how the modern cloud architecture and modern day systems are working. And as you said, like, once you've got it up and running, no one wants to re-architect that stuff. No one wants to put a new component in the middle of something, especially when you're talking about sort of customers and, you know, and production data, or actually getting transactions done. It's a really hard pill for folks to swallow. So I think,
especially with applications that could be hosted around the world, you could have scalability, reliability, network type issues.
That's right. That's right. There's so many other things that sort of drive that. And I can imagine like an enterprise architect trying to go say, hey, we want to centralize all this to a single point, and getting thrown out of the room, because it's just like there's so many other factors in there that drive it. And so I think my personal take is attacking it at the administration point is the right way to go.
We've been talking a lot about, I guess, theory, for lack of a better word, right? How things should work. I always like to hear, like, what's the real world doing in this space? You mentioned some of the clients that you've worked with in the past and some customers you've got. What are some of the use cases, you know, that you've seen where an authorization tool has helped solve some of these real world problems that we're seeing out? Because, you know, I think everyone points back and says, oh, we're a role-based access control company. Okay, are you really? And how good is it? It usually sucks, and it's a pain in the butt to maintain. And, you know, they kind of gave up maybe after, oh yeah, we have five rules, right? Something like that. And I feel like it's a struggle for a lot of organizations out there. Every company that I talk to says that they are or they want to be role-based. And it's hard in the real world, especially when you have these applications that are using their own authorization schemes and they have not moved to you know, a centralized policy decision point or access point or engine or whatever it may be. What are you seeing in the real world around this space? How are, you know, these, how are these things moving forward?
Yeah, I find that, you know, one of the big issues, and I mentioned this before about, you know, the really bad access control crack, but that one of the challenges is, you know, you can do it at a point in time. And typically what I hear is like, you know, hire a systems integrator like Accenture to come in and get, you know, and get like a whole raft of, you know, warm bodies from the consulting org to go and have tons of interviews with every organization across, you know, across the company. And that's a tremendous amount of work. And then,
or better yet, hire RSM to do it.
There you go. But then you get drift over time, and then you get people, you know, and say, well, you know, maybe I'll use this role for something it wasn't quite intended for, but it sounds about right. Or things get tacked onto the role. And so the permissions change, and actually what's in that role changes, the use and what's being applied for changes. And, you know, essentially, you know, then you're going, or you get someone who says, you know, oh, I need this new role for this new purpose. And this sounds about right, but man, I don't really know what that role does. Let me create a new role. And so then you get this proliferation. And so what I find is that most organizations, even when they want to be a role-based access control company, they're trying to manage it just on the name of the role. You know, like when you're trying to say, hey, is this right? It's like the role is named, you know, super secret admin number two. Okay. Like, what does that mean? And people have no idea. And so the thing that surprises me, I think, around all this and the real world customer examples that I see is that oftentimes the things that customers are struggling with is so much simpler than you would ever imagine. And, you know, so one example, we have a very large Fortune 500 company, and they actually went through this, and they, you know, they came to us and said, hey, you know, can you tell us when a new admin is created in Salesforce? We're like, yes, we can do that. And what it turned out to be is that they had an IGA, a very large IGA company that the name you would know as a leader in the IGA space. And they were using that to provision Salesforce. And yet they found that when someone went around that provisioning process, the approved process, and went directly into the Salesforce console, create a new admin in there, their IGA solution couldn't tell them. And they would go around this, and they tried to actually custom code some solutions to do it. And there were just so many different ways to do it. They couldn't find that they could plug all the holes. And what it turned out was that they had failed two SOX audits because of that, right? And so it sounds so simple. And you take someone outside of identity or peripheral to identity and say, you know, do you know, how can you not know when a new admin is created in Salesforce? Like, how is that possible? And yet, that's the thing that these very large, very sophisticated companies are struggling with. And so that's what we see is sometimes it's a compliance driver. It's like when your auditor gets the taste of that and they know that you don't have controls, you can't demonstrate controls, like that is a big deal. And they will drive that, and companies are very, very motivated to fix that. Other times it's just a visibility thing. And I know there was a former CISO of a very large telco that was telling me a story about sort of when he came to believe in authorization as sort of a really key thing. It was actually after an incident. And so they'd had an intruder come in, they'd had an account takeover, and they ended up being able to block that and lock out that account before they lost a lot of data. But he was doing a post-mortem with all of his direct reports. And so he had them, we were all in a room. And he says, all right, here's the first account that got taken over. What did this account have access to? And they all look at each other and they say, we don't know. He's like, okay, here's the second account. How about this one? We don't know. He's like, how is this possible? How can we not do this thing that's so fundamental to security and being able to respond to these types of incidents? So I find different organizations and people come at it from different sides, but inevitably when they dig down and really see what's there and see what they know and what they don't know, it's a little terrifying. And you know, it's such a basic thing. You imagine, like, you know, how is this possible that we can't do this? And yet it's incredibly hard. And it's been a lot harder with the cloud.
Rich, just thinking, like you just told that story, I'm thinking, man, those folks who were in that room and said, we don't know, that must have been just like such an embarrassing and painful moment for them. It's like, it's your job. You know, I mean, yeah. Look, I'm not saying like I would have gotten it right. I'm just saying that I'm sure glad I wasn't in their shoes at that moment, because, you know, when you think about identity, it's ensuring that the right people have the right access, you know, knowing who has access to what. And when you can't answer that question, like, wow, that's downright embarrassing.
It really is. And I think it's, you know, it underscores the fact that like just the tool set hasn't been there. Like, you know, it's like we've done all these advances, and, you know, like we were talking about before, authentication has come a long way in the last five, six, 7 years. The tools that we got available are so much better. And I think, you know, that's another common thread, is the tools for authorization have been pretty stagnant. There just hasn't been a lot. And so, you know, I think back to another guy who was he actually leads the engineering team at his organization. He was telling me a story about, you know, when they didn't have any tools, he said, yeah, the auditors asked me for, you know, everyone who could access this one database. We had to really get in, and the auditor was like, would not let it go. And in order to answer that question of like, who has access to this database, what can they do in this database? He said he had to take his best developer off for a week of custom scripting to go answer it for one database. So now multiply that across, you know, your entire environment, and you just can't do it. Like, you know, you can get the answer, you can figure it out, but the amount of time and effort and energy it takes to do it without a good tool set is brutal.
Well, I think this is where the fundamental question that I always ask folks is, you know, can you answer this question? It's very simple. Who has access to what?
Yep.
And how quickly can you pull that answer together? And how accurate do you think that data is? Because if you can't answer that question, in my mind, your identity and access management program is failing. It's a basic question.
Right. And I also find you really need to dig down, because most people will say, well, yeah, I know, you know, these are the people in these groups. Okay. But, you know, like let's dig a little deeper. Like, yeah.
Nested,
you
know, groups. What does that even mean? It's been, you know, that group is used for 8 different things, one of which was the original intention, right? Stuff like that.
That's right. And, you know, it comes down to, you know, to brass tacks. Usually it's like, you know, pick your, you know, your most sensitive, you know, data element, whether, you know, it's a table, maybe it's a box folder, you know, maybe it's a, you know, a data lake, in Snowflake or something like that, and say like, who can get to that? And exactly what can they do, right? And like it's going down to these data elements, because you know, like I think everybody has somewhat of a handle around users and groups and some connection to role. But I find the biggest gap is, what does that role actually do? What does that mean? Like, what can you actually get to with permissions? And then you get all these other things like, well, what about local permissions? What about local users? What about system accounts and machine identities? And like, you know, now it's pulling on all those threads, where, you know, it's not in the 70 or 80% solution, but it's at the edges. And those are typically the biggest issues when it comes to security and compliance. Those are the ones that you really need to worry about, are those ones that you know, most of the time you have no idea.
Well, you've got the point in time definition. And then what are you doing to make sure that that definition stays the same? Because things change, right?
Exactly.
Do you find that there is a particular platform or system or something that is like the hardest thing to include when we start talking about authorization, maybe even as a program? I think people think of identity as a program. Authorization as a program might need to be a thing as well, considering, you know, that's really the keys of the castle. What are people getting access to? But I've found, you know, doing integrations, different, you know, technologies out there, there are some platforms or systems that are just a real pain in the, you know what, and it's either not well documented, or, you know, you can't do certain things because APIs aren't available, whatever it may be. But what kinds of platforms do you see as like the hardest to include as part of this capturing of who has access to what?
Yeah, from a technical standpoint, the hardest ones are definitely the old and crusty on-prem ERP systems. You know, those are the ones, you know, there's no RESTful API. Like, you've had an SI come in for 8 years and is custom fine tuning it. And so it ends up being something that has very little commonality with anyone else's deployment. And so there's just a tremendous amount of customization, and the hooks are not there. So from a tactical standpoint, those are the hardest ones, or custom applications as well. They're just, you know, they're snowflakes, right? Nobody else has it. And so there aren't a lot of common tool sets to allow you to integrate. But from a program perspective, I actually find it's the other way. where you see that, you know, a lot of times when you look at, you know, identity governance programs, they've got like the ERP system. That was always the number one thing. That was, so that's priority one. So they've actually this, you know, gutted it through and, you know, by, you know, really, you know, brutal house to house search, they've gone and figured that out. But then you say, well, you know, how many apps do you need for SOX, or relevant for SOX compliance and are subject to that? And the, and, you know, the list is like, well, it's like, you know, it's like 30 apps. How many do you have covered in your identity governance program? 3. And, you know, what are you doing about all the rest? And so from a program perspective, it's actually that longer tail. It's the stuff that's still relevant for compliance and they know is there's critical data in it. But usually the lift is so heavy to get these things integrated into an identity governance platform that they have huge gaps and they know that.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things about authorization is you have to make a decision on how far you take your authorization program. So let's say we take one of those apps that you just mentioned, custom built app. Developers have been hammering away on it for decades, maybe, and building like, oh, this view and that view and like things that are not standard. Or take something that's out of the box that I thought you might answer that question with, which is like ERP systems, where especially older ERP systems where you say you have access to this table, this screen, this business unit. So now it's like multi-dimensional access. And it's like, that's just, you know, if you spend your IAM program focused on nailing the authorization for that, that is all you're going to get done. Like you might have an IAM program with a handful of people. So to me, it's kind of been like, okay, so what is our IAM program going to do? It's going to take it this far. It's going to provision a person into these right groups, or it's going to, in real time, present the application with some assertions of authorizations, but they're going to be at this level. It's not going to be like they should be able to see all these tables and things like that. So I guess to translate that back into your real world story where the CISO is like, okay, we're going to take this application, take this account that got compromised. What did they have access to in our ERP system? I would say the IAM team should say, well, we sent these authorizations or we put the person into these roles in these groups. And then somebody from the ERP side should say, be able to say, and that gives them access to these screens and these database tables or things like that, right? But somewhere along the way. So do you have a rule of thumb, or is it really just having that knowledge to be able to say, all right, here's a couple of rules of thumb that we're going to apply?
Yeah, the rule of thumb that I find is, you know, sort of the commonality. If I look at customers who have been the most successful at doing this kind of thing, it's absolutely prioritization is the name of the game. I mean, that's the first thing, is you cannot do everything, right? And so you have to pick your battles. And I find that one of the most valuable things is actually going, you know, starting at the end, right? And like looking at like, okay, what's the most critical data we need to protect? Right. And that's typically the thing that's fundamentally like the board cares about, you know, the CISO, the CIO care about. And so, hey, let's figure out like what roles give access to that and what can they do? Right. And so typically that's where I found it's most valuable, is kind of starting at the end. But to your point, Jim, I think you raised a great point, is like a lot of times this data, to put that whole story together and to get their true visibility all the way down to the data level, it's on different teams. Right? It's in different systems, they're different groups. And, you know, does the identity group really understand the inner workings of the ERP system authorization scheme? Like, heck no. Right? And so, and every single system is different, right? You know, just because you know one system, like you got to kind of be an expert in each one. And that it's that translation across systems, that's also really, really hard. So now you think about, you know, now we boil it back up, and now you're a CISO, and you say, hey, you know, I just want to make sure that no contractor in China gets access to my customer data. Let me make that happen. Now you think about like, what do you have to do in terms of technical controls on every system that might have customer data? What knob do you actually tweak? What's the JSON actually look like for that? That's a really hard thing to answer. Although again, it seems like a very simple kind of thing would be very reasonable for a CISO to want. And yet bringing that and actually putting that into action is super, super hard.
That's a great answer. You know, the other thing that was, as we were talking about, we kept talking about authorization as a program. And I'm not recommending that folks go out there and spin up a program and have an authorization program manager, but it reminded me of the impact that authorization has to humans. I'm not so sure that the impact's on the end user, but definitely the application owners and these application teams and making sure people are clear on roles and responsibilities and to make sure that where I drop it, you pick it up, et cetera. What are your thoughts on that impact? Is there an impact to end users and then the app owners who are app owners, developers, and database administrators, all those folks?
Yeah, absolutely. There's impact on end users because usually it's like, hey, I need access to this thing. I need to get my job done and I need more access. That's typically how it goes. So, you know, obviously you start off with birthright access. You get a bunch of stuff right out of the gate, but it's never enough and it's designed not to be enough. You got to go typically and ask for more. And so then the trick is, okay, how fast can I get that done? Right. If you're a developer that's working on a critical project, like I guarantee you, you have a lot of organizational push behind you to get that access quickly. Right. It's like if it's a revenue facing project and, you know, they need to get it done, like they will push and they will get a lot of backing. It's really hard to say, hey, hold on, we got to figure out our role structure. That's not going to work. Right. You got to get access. That reminded me of another customer example where they started using better tools, right? And just having more insight into what roles actually did can be extremely powerful, even in the provisioning process, right? So their problem was they had Snowflake and they had developers that would come in and actually ask for additional access to something. It might be a table, it might be a database in Snowflake. And so the challenge that they had, and actually the provisioning was done by the Snowflake team just for this very reason, because they were the only ones who sort of understood the inner workings of Snowflake. So the IT team couldn't do it. Right. Then so they actually had to take that on themselves. And back to your second part of your question is, how does this actually impact app owners and sort of data owners? They were actually the ones doing provisioning. And more than not, because it was typically such a mission critical thing that was time sensitive, they over permissioned. Right. And that's the reality. It's like, well, it's like, gosh, I got all these roles. I got like 80 roles. I don't know which one gives access to this table. Oh, let me just give them let me give them the good stuff. Let me give high level access. And so what they were able to do when they actually had some tools that allowed them to see what these roles actually did, like what did this role actually give permissions to, and had that sort of instant level of visibility, they were able to reduce that down. So once they granted a new role, they could really find the one that best conformed to least privilege, right? They could find the one that gave access to that table, but as little else as possible. And just by sort of implementing that, by having the tools around visibility, they were able to reduce the total number of permissions on Snowflake by 80%. That's what they told us. I mean, so it's, you could really see the effect of that. It's not just, hey, does someone have access to Snowflake or not, but what role do they have? And is it enough for them to do their job? This is least privilege at its heart.
All right, I got one last question around authorization before we wrap things up. Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't be an Identity at the Center podcast without mentioning of AI at this point. So how do you see AI impacting this space of authorization?
Yeah, I mean, I think about this a lot, as I'm sure everybody who listens to this podcast does. And I think, you know, there's certainly going to be a lot, some good stuff into like role mining and cluster analysis. And I think there's a lot of goodness there. And also, you know, what we were talking about before, getting to the human component, when you're doing things like access reviews, which is almost always a component of any sort of governance program around authorization, it's really alleviating that human burden. And I think AI can do a really good job there, where AI might not be able to give you the full answer, but it can at least guide you and say, hey, you probably don't need to spend a lot of time on these. Here are the ones that really, you know, look suspicious, right? Or look like you should give it a little more time. I think using it in those kind of situations are really great. And, you know, I think the best example I heard about the power of AI was really, it's like having unlimited interns, right? And so you can do things that are sort of like these sort of relatively menial tasks, but you can do it really fast and you can do it really cheaply. But there still are things where, you know, humans are still better at doing the outliers, right? The really edge case things, you've got to have some humans involved in a lot of those cases, but AI can take a lot of the burden there. The other component and the other side of it is, you know, is, you know, what's going to be the bigger security concerns around authorization protecting AI programs, right? And so that's another interesting one where you now see all these things around, you know, the, you know, like the weights, like after the, you know, these training runs that some of these really large frontier AI companies are doing, you know, it costs like $1 billion to run some of these training things. And so that, you know, the weights, that file that records all the, essentially the results of that training, that is incredibly valuable intellectual property, right? You know, perhaps bigger than anything we've ever seen in history. And so, you know, and then you have nation states that have stated goals around becoming AI leaders. And that combination of having these treasure troves, I think it's going to be a, you know, it's going to really bring security to a whole new level because the value of the thing that we're trying to protect is so large. And it's going to be way beyond even customer data and credit card numbers. And so I think what we'll see is it's really going to force security providers and identity people, identity teams to think about securing this stuff beyond just typical IT level security, but really bringing it up to physical security, getting closer with a lot of sort of the three-letter agencies that are actually protecting it. I think there's going to be a lot more crossover between typical espionage scenarios and risk profiles and what's normally been IT security, not having to worry as much about physical security. I think those things are really going to converge around AI.
I feel like we're headed to a future where an organization's AI becomes sort of like their OS and is their secret sauce. Hopefully not as bad as like iRobot, where it goes a little bit nuts. Has your definition of AI changed within the last couple of years? Because I feel like mine has, and I've talked about this before, where pre, you know, ChatGPT, pre large language model being available to the general public, I thought of AI as, okay, that's cool. It's like machine learning and pattern matching and stuff like that. And then you get something like, you know, ChatGPT or similar, you know, functionality where now it's available to the public and it's this conversational interface. I find myself using it more and more and more for important things and not important things. And my thought process now is that's AI. I don't think of AI as necessarily just machine learning and pattern matching. And I'm curious if you've thought about this from a definition standpoint of, okay, you know, what is AI? Because I feel like, no offense, you know, a lot of vendors have thrown the word AI on the box of their product for years now. And now yep. We're getting to the point where it's like, oh, okay, well, that's interesting. You know, what do you mean by AI? I'm just curious if your definition has changed since the advent and the availability of these things.
Yeah, I think it has. And certainly the way I think about it, you know, I think before ChatGPT, the ChatGPT sort of evolution, you know, I was just, you know, I was always felt embarrassed about using the term AI. That's what it felt like. It was marketing. It felt like it was, you know, something in the future and not here yet, where ML sounded, you know, much more reasonable and like, yes, that's a much more precise term. I think now I feel very comfortable using the term AI. And I think maybe it's just that it's still so new and still revolutionary that it feels very, very different. And, you know, and that's, I've seen that quote before where it's, you know, AI is anything that's just new and not in the current capability set. And it feels like we're still getting our heads around what this really implies. And really, I mean, it is mind blowing, even though it's a next word prediction model, it feels like so much more and it looks like so much more from every angle. It looks startlingly like, you know, an intelligence behind it. So it certainly has changed the way that I treat things and I talk about it.
We're going to start to wrap things up here. And I guess kind of going on the lines of when I think of AI and where things are going as well, I think about the word longevity, because I could see a point where, you know, everyone's got their own AI and maybe there is a, you know, Jeff AI at some point in the future that lists that, you know, exists long after I'm gone. Right. And it's this, you know, facsimile of what, you know, my personality is like or whatever it may be. What's one of the most important things that you think you've learned about longevity?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I know we talked about this before. This has definitely been a passionate of mine to think about this and learn about it. And I think it's really, you know, in the end, longevity is important and longevity is great, but you know, what really matters is what you do with that time, right? It's like, it's not about just living longer, but it's like, you've got to put it to some use. You got to put it to some value. And I think it's that perspective combined with the fact that, you know, if you look into, there are a few, you know, very simple worms out there that actually don't have programmed cellular death, right? And so you look at this, you're like, how can that be? And you look across all these different species and organizations, and I've actually come to the personal perspective, and I've never really heard it stated this way, but that, you know, that a limited lifespan is actually it's a feature, not a bug. And it's actually something that we've evolved. And so, you know, and you can look at it from an evolutionary standpoint, it makes perfect sense. It's like, you know, you got to make room for the new era, for the new folks, for the young people. And so that's come, and that's been a bit of a shock to say, like, wow, I'm sort of, you know, thinking about myself as supposed to have a limited shelf life. And I think it just puts a finer point on that, you know, like if we all knew we were going to live forever, would we really get anything done what we needed to get done today? Like, if like, well, I can always do it tomorrow. I think it's really, you know, thinking about it that way, I think makes you use your time that you have better. And I think that's a good perspective from my point of view.
Well, time is one of the only resources that you can't make more of, really, right?
That everyone's right. Got a certain... only scarce resource is time.
Yeah,
that's right.
And I think, you know, it's one of those things. I think is, you know, I know as I get older, right, I think about, okay, well, how much time do I have left? Am I going to get all the things accomplished that I want? And you're right. If I live forever, and I would just keep kicking that can down the curb, right? And, you know, play video games all day, or, you know, I don't know, set up evil portals, whatever it may be. Jim, what do you think about longevity?
Well, I really enjoyed listening to what Rich had to say, because I think perspective about longevity is so important. I think it changes over time too. You know, I have in my mind, I'd like to live to about 80. I feel like that's where the human body wears out. But on my 80th birthday, am I going to say, well, I'd like to die tomorrow? Heck no. I'm going to set a new goal. I'm going to find new reasons why and new ways to find meaning out of my life. But I will say, you know, I had a passing away happen in my family recently, and it got me onto a YouTube worm, which was rabbit hole, watching these videos. They were Frontline videos. Frontline has like some really great content on YouTube, but it was, you know, about the aging process and going into, like, you know, when people die, if they don't have a living will, like, someone can decide, like, keep this person alive for as long as possible. And they're a vegetable in a bed for five years or whatever until there's nothing that can be done to keep them alive anymore. So I know I don't want to be there, right? And I also see, like, people in the nursing homes that are just, like, staring off into space. I don't want to be there. So I want to live life to the point where I'm enjoying life. And I think everybody has to kind of like assign meaning to, like, yes, that's the kind of life I want to live, or I don't want to live that kind of life. I don't know. But leave it to me to take the lighter note and bring it there, Jeff.
Yeah, you're a real expert at that. I was going to say, I could pull a Seinfeld and, like, you know, grab the pillow, and when you say it's ready, okay, you know, put it over the face, like, all right, we had a good run, Jim.
8 years in one day.
Yeah, I'm like, I set my calendar now. All right, here's a bonus question. Let's see if we could try to revive the lighter part of it. There's a lot of different items out there where people are trying to live longer and with the expectation that something in the future might help them. And I'm thinking specifically on things like cryogenics, right? There's, I don't know, Arizona or something, like, right? There's a warehouse full of people who have been frozen with the hopes that someday they'll be able to be woken up to cure whatever, you know, issue that they had. Some people, it's their entire body. Some people, it's just the head, which I find kind of creepy and very Futurama to some degree. Would you consider that?
I don't think I would. I mean, it's those things where, again, maybe it'll work. That's possible. But, you know, well, I guess maybe another good question is, like, yeah, would you upload your consciousness if you could? Would you upload that into the computer, or just, you know, just save it as a backup somewhere? Mm-hmm. maybe I would do that. Somehow that seems a little less creepy, but when I think about it, it's probably just as equally creepy.
Jim, would you freeze yourself? Or I was thinking personally too of, like, the you know, the Jeff AI, right? The backing up your personality somehow, right? Where it's good, but would you
do anything like that? No, I wouldn't do that, but I want to... throw a few things out there since I'm such an expert on this topic. One is,
get ready, folks.
I think from like a supplement perspective, should be taking vitamin D3 every day and in concert with vitamin K2. I also think that there's a supplement called N-acetyl-L-cysteine, or NAC for short. It's very cheap. It's one of the great advances and great findings in the area of longevity. So check those out. Do a little research. Watch longevity videos, man. There's so much out there. But it
do a lot of research.
Another rabbit hole.
We're not a medical show. I take vitamin Snickers.
L-cysteine is cheap. I don't think anybody's making a lot of money on that.
Yeah, I'll make my pitch for fish oil too. Like, I have a hard time eating enough fish. I think that's one of the best researched and most clear advantages. Get your omega-3s. Take a couple tablespoons. It's good for you.
Agree on that.
I want somebody to create a brownie sundae that is healthy, that I can eat a lot of. Then I'll be a happy person.
Nice.
So, Jeff, do you want to be frozen or what?
I don't know if I would be frozen, but this idea of being able to somehow come up with sort of an AI intrigues me. I would do that. I think that would be interesting. I think I would like to do it while I'm still alive to see how it would work and kind of tune it, right? I don't know what would go into it other than, you know, I mean, at some point, I'm guessing somebody could take all these episodes. We've done 200 plus, 231, I think is this one. That's a lot of audio content that kind of shows Jim, you and I, our personality, and you know, at least with, you know, the one that we put out on the podcast, somebody could very easily take that, dump it into a large language model and create a, you know, replica based on what it understands. I'm sure, you know, obviously there'd be gaps and stuff like that, but I don't think it's too far off where, you know, you'd be able to talk to yourself or a famous person, right? Or whatever it may be, where there is enough audio or written or visual content that can be consumed to create something.
Well, then you just need to ask Alexa to start recording all your conversations and you'll have more, there'll be more data. It'll be
Isn't she already doing that? I don't know. I guess I thought that was already par for the course. All right, let's go ahead and wrap up for this week. Rich, thank you so much for being part of this. It was a great conversation. We're going to have links in our show notes to a whole bunch of different stuff. We'll have links to Rich on LinkedIn, so you can connect with him, ask him questions, compliment him on his radio pipes, you know, whatever it may be. We'll have a link to Veza.com, VEZA.com, so you can learn more and more about what those guys are selling over there. We'll have a whole bunch of links to all the different conferences that Jim and I mentioned, Identity Week America, Octane, Authenticate Conference. We've got a bunch of discount codes. If you're planning on attending any of those, use our codes. They should be the best, and it also shows support for the show, that sort of thing. And you can find us on the internet, IDACpodcast.com. We're on Twitter or X or whatever at IDACpodcast. We're on Mastodon at IDACpodcast at infosec.exchange. Of course, we're in all the different podcast stores, like, subscribe, all that good stuff. That's what keeps Jim and I encouraged to keep this thing running along. Share it with a friend, share it with an enemy. Don't care, as long as someone's listening, we'll keep doing our thing. And Jim, I didn't tell you this yet, but I am working on figuring out how we get on YouTube. So YouTube has made some podcast announcements recently. Mm-hmm. And so I'm starting to slowly upload hundreds of episodes when I get time to have them on YouTube at some point as well. So not ready yet, but it's coming. It's in the future. And I did recently find a way LinkedIn page for the show. I think right now you and I are the only people on it, but I'm starting to tag it and sort of build it out and figure out how that all that stuff works. So Excellent. There we go. All right. We'll leave it there for this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And we'll talk with everyone in the next one.
You've been listening to Identity at the Center. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, hit the website at identityatthecenter.com and find us on Twitter at IDAC Podcast. See you next time on Identity at the Center.